Well, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, March 2nd, 2015. Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we are going to talk about the controversy over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to the U.S. Congress about Iran, the recent CPAC gathering of conservatives and what that means, or doesn't, whether California or how California is facing the challenges of, say, the next 5 years, the what I'm calling the anti-vaxxer movement in Sacramento, and the effects, we'll talk about a number of economic issues, such as the West Coast ports shutdown. The anti-vaxxers, vaccinations movement. Yes.
Thought it was dicey.
As usual, any of the opinions expressed up here are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now, let me introduce our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Josh Richman, the state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group. He's also a political blogger at ibabuzz.com/politics, and he's on Twitter at Josh_Richman. Next to him is Melissa Griffin Kane, a contributor to CBS SF with Mornings with Melissa, and to San Francisco Magazine. She's also an attorney, and you can find her on Twitter at Mel Griffin Kane. And next to me is Carson Bruno, a research fellow at Hoover Institution, where he specializes in California's political and policy landscape. He's on Twitter at Carson J.F. Bruno. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and send up any questions. I will do my best to get as many of them asked during the program as possible.
Josh has had a birthday, so if you want to just write, happy birthday, Josh.
Thank you.
You should do that, too.
We would have had cake. Last time we had was actually the third anniversary of Week to Week. Remember, we had little cupcakes for those of you who were here. We should have, if we knew you were coming.
Please don't.
Well, let's talk about an international issue that has become a political issue domestically, or also a domestic issue that has become an international issue. I don't know how to, which direction it went. But Speaker of the House John Boehner sent an invocation for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress. This rankled the White House, which wasn't informed ahead of time. It also rankled congressional Democrats, and it's also causing criticism for Netanyahu back in Israel. So let's talk about Boehner's move, the president's response, the prime minister's role, and the whole messy saga. It's frankly, this isn't just a speech. I mean, this is shaping up to be the international political equivalent of like Oscars week, you know, or Super Bowl week. It's not just the speech itself. There's the speech to AIPAC that Netanyahu gave, was it yesterday or today?
Today.
Then there are all the other AIPAC speeches that other politicians and commentators are giving on both sides of the political aisle. Then there's all the chatter about who will or will not be attending the Oscars, I mean, the congressional speech. And finally, there's the speech itself, which...
Who are you wearing?
Yes, there will be the red carpet. So, Josh, what was John Boehner trying to do with this invitation, do you think, and did he succeed?
Well, he was trying to do exactly what you would expect him to do. That's kind of amazes me about this conflict, is that everybody's doing exactly what you would think they would do, right? So, you know, John Boehner is trying to unify his caucus any way he can, and this is a good way for him to both score political points against the White House and the Democrats, who are trying to make the Democrats look like they're not as friendly to Israel and perhaps woo some Jewish and other Israel-oriented voters to their side of the aisle. And he's also sort of building the case for more sanctions against Iran sooner without waiting for the Kerry negotiations to proceed. The president is doing exactly what you would expect him to do, which is saying, Secretary of State reports to me, let us do our job, let us negotiate this situation with Iran in a way that benefits the United States and Israel and the fight against ISIS and everything else that's going on in that entire quadrant of the world. And Netanyahu's definitely doing what you would expect him to do. who would turn down an invitation like this? He, you know, he gets to come here shortly before his country's elections and sort of bolster him his image while making a case for his country's national security interests as they see it. So he's doing that. And Congress is behaving the way that you would expect them to behave, which is a lot of them for the past week were all going, So, you know, we ended up polling our Bay Area members of Congress to see who was going to go, who wasn't going to go. One never responded. A few said, we'll decide closer to the show. You know, there's a lot of waffling going on. In the end, the only three I know who are not showing up are Barbara Lee, which is what you would expect her to do. Zoe Lofgren, which is a little bit more surprising, but still kind of what you would expect her to do. And Jerry McNerney, who was sort of, you know, on the cusp. He's the guy who used to have a swath of the East Bay. Now he's more Stockton-oriented. You know, a Democrat, but a little bit more of a centrist Democrat than much of the Bay Area delegation by dint of his, you know, Central Valley location and stuff. But they basically said, look, wasn't Boehner's place to invite him. You know, we're trying to accomplish something through the State Department. It's inappropriate. I'm not going to go.
What about Dianne Feinstein? She's Democrat. Is she going to go?
I think she had actually sought a separate meeting with the Prime Minister while he was going to be in town and was rebuffed. The Prime Minister said, if there's a bipartisan group of senators that wants to meet with me in addition to the speech, I will do that. But there were only a couple of Democrats who were on that list, so he said no.
Carson, I mean, what do you think the Reagan White House would have done if Tip O'Neill had said, oh, by the way, we've just invited Mitterrand, or it's not a great analogy, but, sure. You know, you get the idea.
Oh, I mean, he totally would have spun it to his advantage politically and communication-wise, I mean, along the lines. I mean, it's kind of hard to go backward because the fundamentals of the Middle East and the politics in D.C. in the Middle East have changed dramatically over the past few years. Mm-hmm. Pew Study actually just did a great look at looking at Republican views versus Democratic views of kind of who they sympathize most with, the Israelis or the Palestinians. And you're seeing a very widening gap between Republicans and Democrats where 20, 30 years ago, it would much, much more been everyone in the same camp siding with Israel. Now you're kind of seeing the Republicans increasingly becoming pro-Israel and Democrats starting to trend toward pro-Palestinian, which is factoring into kind of who's deciding to go and who's deciding not to go. But the people not going is a very small minority of the Democratic caucus still.
But that does seem to be causing a bit of a problem, right? I mean, at least even today in his speech at AIPAC, Netanyahu said, you know, this should not be a bipartisan issue. This should not be a partisan issue. And my understanding from what we know from various journalists and observers in Israel is that they're concerned. They're saying we agree with what he's saying, which is don't give any concessions to Iran, but we're not thrilled that he's doing it in the way that he's doing it because it's now that we're aligned with the Republican Party, let's say another Democrat gets in the White House. Now, what does that mean for our standing in the world and our, you know, special relationship with the U.S. if we become too closely wed to the Republican Party? That's actually a negative for them, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, almost, according to the Washington Post, almost 200 former Israeli generals and top security officials said that Netanyahu's speech to Congress could undermine ties between Israel and the U.S. and could actually help Iran. A former Mossad chief is, in fact, leading a big rally against him. I mean, Carson, how much of this is Israeli politics? I mean, it's election time there. How much of this is U.S. politics? How much of this is maybe really actually about security?
I think very little is actually about security. Very, very, very little. You know, what Josh was saying, and this is politics, it's political theater, just how the State of the Union now is political theater. These sort of speeches are political theater. And I don't know much about Israeli politics, but I have to imagine they operate very similar to the United States does. So I imagine it must be a lot of politics going on as well. What I'm interested in seeing is if this is a coordinated sort of effort for 2016, Republicans trying to bolster their share of the electorate within the Jewish communities, particularly Florida, which in a close election, the Jewish communities in Florida can be an important chunk.
Well, I know it's on our list of topics today, but at CPAC, for example, not a single speaker that I listened to probably 12 speakers, not a single one failed to mention this. Mm-hmm. Failed to, who was it? It was Scott, no, it was Rick Perry, who said
that wasn't a laugh line, or was it?
He came in one of his, you know, pieces of red meat he threw to the audience. He said, "Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state." Amen. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, Rick.
Did he have smart glasses on?
Yeah, right. He had his super smart. And was it Marco Rubio who, again, was sort of throwing red meat out and said, you know, we need a foreign policy that treats, we have a foreign policy that treats the Ayatollah of Iran better than the Prime Minister of Israel. So those are just some examples of lines that were said. But they were said there were big applause lines at CPAC. It seems that this has become increasingly a part of the Republican sort of platform. And to your point, you know, in 2016, this is what they're aiming to be, sort of that, to make this sort of their charge. They're certainly lining up to do it.
Let's take a poll. So President Obama said he would not meet with Netanyahu. The reason he gave was that it's 2 weeks before the election in Israel. It's not a proper meeting for the president to have, you know, to get entangled in that. Raise your hand if you think he should be meeting with Netanyahu. Do you think he should meet with him?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm assuming then if you don't think he should meet, raise your hand. Okay. Well, what do you folks think?
They don't like each other anyway. I mean, it seems like
these two do not get along.
I mean, pretty openly. Wasn't it unique in its openness. There's not hostility, but, you know, they're not Facebook friends.
Wasn't there one of those caught on mic things with Obama and was it the former French president, Sarkozy, where basically one of them was complaining about him, the other one, I think Obama, said something to the effect of, yeah, well, I have to talk to him all the time. So let's move on to another topic then. Let's talk closer to home, and that's California. And I wanted to take a bit of a futuristic look, at least a short-term futuristic look, if you will. Back in January, Carson joined us for the first time with his Hoover colleagues. And it was a special week-to-week program in which we featured the release of their Hoover survey on Californians' views about the state government and state leadership. Recently, a new field poll asked state residents other questions, trying to get a sense of what they thought about the direction the state was moving in. In general, the field poll found Californians mostly positive about the direction of the state and optimistic for its future. So I wanted to talk about issues that will be important over the next, say, 5 years, California 2020, let's call it, and whether our political leaders are prepared to deal with things or even are already laying the groundwork for some of these things, such as long-term droughts, a changing economy, population shifts, and other changes. So, Carson, you recently wrote about the state's population and really its moderating growth. So tell us a bit about that, and is that a problem?
Sure. The Department of Finance puts out population estimates every July. So I did a piece of looking at that report. And what you find is they break it down by natural increases, which is, you know, births minus deaths, and then also the immigration issues. So that's domestic migrants moving in and out of California, but also international immigration in and out of California. And what you find is, you know, births are slowing in California. Deaths are increasing in California. So on the natural increases portion of population, California is actually kind of starting to shrink. Not dramatically so, but enough to kind of cause concern. That makes sense. California is aging. You see that across the board. That happens. The United States is aging. It's not an issue just happening in California. What is particularly could be painful for California moving forward is the fact that more and more people are moving out of California domestically than moving in, and the international immigration is remaining quite stagnant, static. And so you're not seeing massive bumps in international migration into California while more people are moving out of California. That's going to cause problems, I think, down the road, because what you're currently seeing is now the current population is aging, which causes a lot of stress on a bunch of government programs, but you're not getting any sort of influx in younger individuals. And the ones that you are, the one that you are, tend to be international immigrants who tend to be lower income, less educated, and so they need a little bit extra help to kind of get themselves started once they get here. So you're kind of getting hit on both sides.
Yeah. Is the international immigrant profile, if you will, different, for example, in the Bay Area? We tend to think
absolutely.
Of,
yeah.
You know, we're getting a lot of folks in the biotech and the high-tech areas.
Yeah, it's easy for us here to kind of always think of California being Silicon Valley, the Bay Area. But, you know, the state would be in a lot better position if it were. But, you know, yeah, the Southern California international immigrant is much different than what you find coming to the Bay Area here. So that's causing a little bit of difficulties. And then throw on top of that the fact that the United States really isn't dealing with immigration reform, which is just exasperating this problem.
When we're talking about immigrants, or I should just say the total population, does that take into account the undocumented immigrants, or...?
To my best knowledge, no, it doesn't.
Okay.
That there are others. Pew tries to kind of estimate those.
Yeah.
DHS tries to estimate that. But to my best knowledge, the California government does not.
Is there any indication that anyone is doing anything to prepare for this coming issue?
It doesn't seem to me, no.
Okay.
Sacramento seems to be trying to put out the fires they have started years ago. And so I think they have their hands full of trying to deal with the drought that's now in its fourth year, right. The transportation where our roads are falling apart at their seams, continuing to fund high-speed rail, which is causing problems throughout the Central Valley. I mean, you have a lot of different issues. I think this one is something that they either aren't really looking into quite yet or are just trying to put off. Because the immigration issue is a federal issue. There's very little California can do when it comes to immigration reform. Besides advocating, getting our congressmen, getting our senators to try to push it forward.
Yeah, but aren't there ways we could incentivize larger families? I mean, isn't that...
Yes, yeah, you could do that. What it's actually interesting to look at, when you look at who's leaving the state on domestic migration, they tend to be middle-income young families or people just out of college. California is very good about getting college-age people into the state, not very good about keeping them here once they graduate. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's a very expensive state to live in, and it's hard to find good-paying jobs now.
We were talking before the program about the problem with affordable housing, and you could just put it that even wider is just the affordability of housing.
Yeah.
Here in San Francisco, of course, it's a very, very hot topic, but down in Silicon Valley, you've been, I guess, doing some work on this. I mean, it's a big thing there. What are the businesses saying down there about employees and their problems?
Right. The Silicon Valley Leadership Group puts out a great annual survey of Silicon Valley CEOs. And what they consistently rank as one of the biggest challenges for their businesses, but also then for their employees, is housing costs.
Mm-hmm.
That outranks CEQA, that outranks taxes, that outranks a lot of other things. It's housing costs. So you're finding it could be a significant business challenge, but it's not just Silicon Valley. The average median home sale price is a little over $401,000 now in California. That's a lot of money. You know, that takes to be able to afford that, you need an average annual household income of roughly $70,000 to $80,000. Household median income in California is just a little bit over $60,000. So you see a significant gap there in what people are making versus what they can afford.
I saw that today on sfgate.com where they had an article kind of going into that exact thing. If you live in San Francisco, you want to afford a kind of standard house, what would you need to earn? I think it was $142,000
here
in the city. So get to work. Well, let's talk about this drought. I mean, there are, I'm going to go with Josh first, on maybe perhaps on the state policy side. I mean, we saw in November there was a proposition that was dealing with some kind of water movement and management issues.
Right.
But there are some scientists now talking about, drought might be the new normal, or
yeah,
at least
it doesn't help to move or manage water that isn't there. So yeah, as he was saying, water and transportation infrastructure are huge. As Don McLean sang, you drive your Chevy to the levee, but the levee is dry, right? but we also still have some enormous fiscal and governance issues that we're dealing with at the same time. First and foremost, these field polls show time and again that people say, if there's more money, we want to spend it on education. We want to spend it on K-12. We want to spend it on higher education, both of which, have took tremendous hits. The tuition rates at UC and CSU have been a huge issue over the last couple of years. They're trying to work out a deal to hold the line, even though the line is now up here, They don't want it to go any higher. The problem is, the reason that we've been able to hold the line up here, even at this point, is because of Prop 30, which voters approved a couple of years ago. That was Jerry Brown's tax increase initiative, which increased sales taxes and increased income taxes on the state's richest residents. Problem is, that's a temporary increase. That sunsets. It's going to go away. And the governor has said repeatedly that he saw it as a temporary thing. You know, when people ask him, as we invariably do whenever we see him, what do you think about extending Prop 30? He says, I thought it was a temporary tax increase. So we're going to come to this crossroads in the next couple of years where we decide, do we try to convince voters and find the political will, again, that we need to make these things permanent, or do we lose the billions of dollars that we've been, you know, restoring K-12 with and holding the line somewhat on higher education with? That's the hugest chunk of the general fund of the budget, as you probably know. If you put K-12 and higher education together, it's somewhere between 50% and 60% of the budget right there.
Wow.
So you can't really talk about the budget without figuring out what to do with those things, and you can't really take a whole lot of money out of the budget without affecting those things. At the same time, we also still have a huge public pension liability issue, a bill that's going to come due in coming decades, where we've promised people essentially more money than we have. And that is something that the more fiscally hawkish people have been saying, you got to do something about this right now. And we've tinkered around the edges of it, but we haven't really addressed it yet. So, yes, things are better fiscally, you know, on a government level than they were a couple of years ago. But they're not going to stay there unless we find some way to continue this season of general agreement that we've had. You know, the Republicans didn't like Prop 30, but they didn't have a lot of choice. They're now in the minority, although not the super minority exclusively anymore. And yet, you know, when Governor Brown puts out his budgets, what you've generally heard from Republicans in the last 2 years has been, okay. You know, it could be worse, you know, because they know that he's actually holding a lid on the members of his party who just want to start cranking back, you know, all of the spending that they had to cut in the years before that. So all of these bills essentially come due at the same time that we're grappling the population, you know, and demographic changes, the water issues, the crumbling infrastructure, and all of that.
And you hope that the economy stays.
And you can hope that the economy stays. Yeah, I mean, you know, if the economy were to tank again, it's hard to see how the state would remain solvent without extending Prop 30.
Well,
you know,
and we
may be able to grow our way out of it if things keep going well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. I mean, we're really dependent on the performance of Silicon Valley to balance the state budget, to just kind of keep gushing out money. And when Silicon Valley stumbles, of course,
and to a lesser extent on agriculture, which is in a drought, right?
So. Yeah. Melissa, you were talking recently about something in Arizona. And why am I going to Arizona when we're talking about California? Because we're these two states that have done something to try to deal with a structural governmental issue called redistricting. Tell us what Arizona did and what's going on with them right now, and then we can talk about why on earth it affects us.
So today, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments, while we're talking about this today. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case involving the Arizona State Legislature back in 2000. The Arizonians, wisely, I think, voted to remove the power of redistricting and give it to an independent citizens commission. You guys might recall we did that here in 2008 and then in 2010. And so there's this provision in the United States Constitution that says that time, place, and manner of elections are to be determined by the state legislature. And so what happened is in Arizona, the independent citizens commission came in and they independently drew those lines, and the Republicans were pretty mad because they put three congressional districts into play that were not before. And so they sued, and they said, because of the U.S. Constitution provision saying we, the state legislature, get to determine all the election stuff, you took that away from us. That's unconstitutional. Right? So that's the lawsuit. That was the argument that was heard today. the reason it's important to us is because Arizona and California are the only two states that do this, that have totally independent commissions. About 16 other states have kind of varying degrees of citizen input in redistricting. Some of them have like advisory panels and things like that. But we're the only two that really just totally ripped it away. Again, wisely, I think. And are moving forward in that way. So if Arizona's goes down, then it's pretty clear that ours is too. There's almost no way California's current system of citizen redistricting will survive if Arizona's gets struck down. And this is harmful for a lot of reasons. Number one, it's really popular. Like, people love this. Like, parties hate it. Like, both parties hate it, right? In Arizona, the Republicans hate it because it took away their power. In California, the Democrats hate it because it took away their power. Parties hate it. People love it. So this is, you know, hopefully this will not be struck down, but we can talk more about what happened today at oral argument. The other issue is, if you take it to its sort of strictest reading of the Constitution says time, place, and manner of elections is determined by the state legislature, what does that mean for other things that we have passed by initiative? Things like the top two primary. In other states, voter ID laws have been passed in that way. So there are all these initiatives, literally hundreds of citizen initiatives across the country that could go down if the justices say, nope, legislature is legislature, and that's it, and we're not going to read anything more into it, and we're done. And that's why this is such a big deal. Some of our favorite things, and I don't know if you love the top two primary, some people do, but some of the things that we've done as a citizenry that people really like are things that we had to go sort of outside of the legislature to do. And so the U.S. Supreme Court could really undo a lot of that today with the case that was argued today. We'll get a decision by June, but that's why that this is the case that was argued today was important to the future of California, to your
point. So if they strike it down, we could go back to the glory days of 2007 in California.
Nobody loses. The same party in power stays in power, and everybody gets reelected. That's the end game. I mean,
everybody's
that's the end
the
result.
Winner.
Everybody is.
Yeah,
amazing.
Those maps, the ones that were set after mm-hmm. the 2000 census, were so ridiculous in some cases. Man, just some of the Bay Area districts and the ones extending out into the Central Valley, they had these amazing little loops and tentacles, and there's all kinds of ridiculousness going on. It's interesting that we're basically debating a constitutional right to game the system, you know, because that's really what this is, you know. It still happens in most other states. You know, the legislature in Arizona is fighting for its right to redraw districts so that the party in power can win more seats. That is what they are doing. But strict constructionists, who's, you know, as you said before, who see the word legislature are going to say, well, it says legislature, so... Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, like today at oral argument, like Scalia was like, I don't know what to tell you. I see L-E-G. You know, like he was pretty, I think he's going to rule against that. So it's not clear exactly. I mean, Justices Kennedy and Breyer seem to be the two swing votes. So it's not exactly clear sort of where they're going to go. But it was interesting that because the bigger impact would be in California, again, where Republicans are kind of cool with it. Generally, with this redistricting commission, and then you had the Republican-appointed justices, really the strict constructionists coming out against the Arizona commission. So, again, what a lot of people theorize is that in states like Pennsylvania, some of the immigration reform doesn't get through because people are so gerrymandered into a district that is not that has no immigrants in it. Let's say that, there's a thought that this could be really helpful in other states. If you started to do these independent citizens commissions, you could actually get some progress nationally on some bigger issues. So because people won't just be pandering to a very, very specialized little box, you know, present in a bow with a bow that is for them especially. And so what would be really disappointing if the Arizona legislature were to win this case is that would pretty much eliminate any hope of that happening, and you would just see more of the same gerrymandering, more of the same people going to Congress who don't care about anything because that doesn't have an impact, a direct impact in their own district, and they're sort of free to do whatever they want to do. And so that's the bigger issue, the bigger play at issue, is that it would stop any hope of any of that spreading, which we would hope maybe would happen.
Well, every time I hear discussions of the Supreme Court and the oral arguments that take place, and then trying to figure out what they're going to do, it always does kind of come down to, oh, you know, Justice Scalia was saying this, or the liberal justices were, you know, asking really tough questions. How often does that really play out in their decision making? Are those at all reliable, or is that just they ask tough questions sometimes, or
there's always
they had
this
a bad
hope.
Breakfast?
And I could say, having done oral argument and been totally grilled and ripped apart, there's always this hope that you go, well, maybe they were just being really tough on me because they want to flesh out their own arguments, and they want to agree with me, and they want to make sure that it all works. But no, it never works like that. they always pretty much rule like you think they're gonna. Again, there's swing votes that you can't peg, but if someone's sure. mean to you in oral argument, they're probably going to vote against you. That is kind of how it works. So it is actually a pretty good predictor. It seemed like Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg were pretty well for the commission. The Obama administration sent a lawyer to argue in favor of the commission. They're in favor of it. And then again, Scalia. Well, Clarence Thomas never says anything, but he's strong, silent type. But he did. The Scalia did seem to be articulating a particular line of thought that Thomas would probably be on. And Kennedy and Breyer kind of asked questions on both sides. So that's where we get that incredible insight of who was mean and who was nice and who was kind of on both of them.
Very good. Okay. A question from the audience. Why isn't California trying to recoup damages from the companies responsible for the Broken Bay Bridge? I know there are a lot of people who want to know that. Can they get blood from a stone or whatever the phrase is?
But by the time you get that money, it'll be time to build another bridge.
Right, yeah.
That'll be the Gavin Newsom span. Okay. Well, let us talk about another topic. We're going to ping pong over to the other side of the continent. People on both sides of the political divide for this past week were following the news and the personalities and the speeches at the big event known as CPAC, or the Conservative Political Action Committee. It's kind of a right-wing palooza, if you will. All or almost all of the conservative leaders were there, including many 2016 presidential hopefuls. Let's talk about CPAC, what happened, what it says about the conservative movement and mood at this time. Carson? How did Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, do?
You know, he was, I think, my biggest surprise of when I was watching some of the clips, because here's someone who is perceived as a moderate within the party, although when you look at his record, he did govern Florida quite conservatively.
Yeah.
But within the party, because of his stances on immigration and Common Core, he is perceived as the moderate, as the establishment moderate. And for CPAC, being the establishment moderate really isn't the place where you want to go and hang out. But he went in there. He took questions from Sean Hannity, which actually turned out fairly good for him. Sean Hannity really didn't grill him too hard, framed questions to really highlight some of some of his record from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And he held his own. You know, what was most interesting, though, was he didn't pander to the audience.
Right.
He said what he believes on immigration, just like he does any other event he goes to. He said what he believes on Common Core, just like every single event he goes to. And so you're starting to see kind of how his campaign will probably really be like he said it would, that he's going to stick to his principles and move forward on it. And the Republicans kind of take it as they want, the voters. So it'll be interesting to see if that continues down the road.
Yeah, the BBC said that mentioning Mr. Bush was a good way to prompt a smattering of boos on Thursday. They mean B-O-O-S, not B-O-O-Z-E.
It also showed some of his organizational...
What do you mean?
His organization is already really ramped up. They packed that room with so many supporters just for that speech. And they were apparently registering everyone to get a wristband to make sure they had phone numbers, email addresses, mailing addresses.
Did they give them red, green stickers?
I think it was. If I had to guess, it was probably a nice big red wristband.
Probably.
You know, had Bush all over it. But they're obviously showing that they have the organizational capabilities that a lot of these campaigns probably won't have. which is a big deal going into the early primary states.
I have to say, I disagree a little bit. I think that he was pandering. I think that he had to, when Sean Hannity asked him, you know, do you believe in Common Core, he had to say yes. He's clearly on record as saying it. So he's stuck. Like, I don't want to confuse, like, I'm stuck as being on the record as saying more moderate things for I'm sticking to my principles. You're stuck to your principles. And the Common Core, his record on in-state tuition for undocumented students, he had to go with that because he did it. I mean, it didn't seem to me like he was really ignoring the audience at all. As soon as Sean Hannity asked him, he said, there's a rumor that you're telling donors behind closed doors that you're the real moderate. And Jeb Bush was like, no, I am not a moderate, not a moderate. And the audience, yay. So he really, and then they asked him about immigration, which people I think that is kind of a weak spot for him among conservatives. And he immediately started, his very first thing was, let's secure the border, let's get money down there, let's get troops down there. And he was very much, you know, he very much followed the playbook of, you know, there's sort of things that we have to do for immigration reform. Number one is secure the border. So, he wasn't totally, you know, Ted Cruz just throwing out, you know, red meat to the audience, but he did. He certainly wasn't trying to play up his moderate credentials. He was completely disavowing them, and I think to the extent that he was moderate at all, it was because he had to say he couldn't deny the things that he had done.
What he didn't do, though, was the Mitt Romney, I'm severely conservative.
Severely. He called himself a practicing conservative.
Yeah,
practicing.
Yes.
Practicing reform.
A practicing reform conservative.
So you know, that's a big to do, in my opinion, if you can go into there and not pull a Romney and are stumbling over yourself trying to become someone that you obviously are not.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not like we've never seen a presidential candidate run away from things he did as the governor of a state.
Right.
I mean, Romney care,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Come on,
yes.
You know. But you know, I agree. Jeb seems to be, at least as the immigration thing goes, I don't think he wants to pander to them. I think he sees his immigration stance as the only thing that sets him apart from the rest of the Republican field, and in fact, maybe the only thing that can get him elected president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think he realizes that just the way the Electoral College map, you know, where the Electoral College votes are, if you are strictly against anything that most people in that conference would call amnesty,
right.
You know, which is, you know, some sort of path to legal status or citizenship or whatever, you're just not going to carry enough states to be president, you know. And if he can stay with that, it's not a matter of pandering to them. It's a matter of sticking to the only platform he sees having a winning path, I think, at this point. So
now there was another speaker who did kind of change his views on immigration, and that's Scott Walker, who was one of the darlings of the CPAC convention or conference, whatever it is. He also had kind of a rough week. He was kind of bombarded a number of different directions. He was asked, you know, do you think President Obama loves this country after Rudy Giuliani made his comments? And he basically said,
the Giuliani comments were made at a Walker fundraiser.
Oh, that's right.
So there was
right.
a reason he was asked.
Well, yeah. Could have had an answer. I'm from Wisconsin. We were able to give answers. Did Walker do himself any favor this week?
I think he is really learning just how difficult it is to be on the national stage.
Yeah.
You know, he thought the recall put him on the national stage. It didn't. It put him into somewhat of prime time, but not really the 7 o'clock news prime time. So I think he's stumbling, but now's the time to stumble.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we're still a year away from the Iowa caucuses, you know. No one's really paying attention to 2016 quite yet.
We're subjecting these people to it.
I know a lot of the pundits, you know, the three of us are, you know, some other pundits are, the reporters are, but most voters are not. So now's the time to make these stumbles because you learn.
Okay. Well, maybe briefly then, the other darling was Rand Paul. What did you think of his presentation or his reception there? He won the straw poll, by the way, right, as the favorite of that, you know, as I, you know, that and $4 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, Rand Paul sort of represents the, you know, that libertarian side of the party, which has been very critical of the government surveillance programs, but also, you know, takes very libertarian conservative views on other things. It's interesting that he won this poll and not somebody like a Huckabee or a you know, one of the religious conservatives, or Santorum even for that matter. Mm-hmm. Remember, Rick Santorum carried Iowa you know, but for all the good it did him in the end. But yeah, it's. I think there's just there are so many Republicans out there, even mm-hmm. now, who just cannot feel comfortable with embracing that libertarian wing and moving completely out of the neocon sort of mindset and getting over there. It's all well and good to win the straw poll at CPAC, but if you can't win primaries, you know, it just ain't going to happen. He does have the blessing, of course, you know, looking forward, he's going to inherit a lot of the ground machine that his dad
that catapulted his dad to the White House
over decades, you know, essentially.
Yes.
So when we talk about the importance of having a good ground game mm-hmm. early on, having good organization, he's got that.
Yeah.
And now it's just a matter of sort of building on that and actually getting voters to the polls for him. It's too early to tell if he can actually do it.
Well, this you know, is there's no way to have a truly representative conference of folks, but it is an insight into at least part of the conservative movement, and certainly is one of their big events. Carson, did you kind of watch what was going on and get some sense of, you know, as a snapshot, where's the conservative movement today, the activists? What are they different from, say, the CPACs of previous years?
You know, not necessarily different from previous years, mm-hmm. but what I was struck by was how the mood, the message was still decidedly anti-Obama.
Certainly. I would have been very surprised if they had turned around and said, great.
No. so would I. I mean, I would have probably fallen off the couch.
We were wrong.
But in the sense that, you know, Obama's a lame duck president nowadays.
Okay.
You know, the Democrats do not control Congress, and they won't control Congress potentially until 2016 if they can win back the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that the conservative movement is not moving on to the next stage, 2016. You know, it's very apparent who the Democratic nominee will be, Hillary Clinton. So it's interesting that only one, to my knowledge, speaker, Carly Fiorina, former Californian, was really the only one who kind of talked about Hillary Clinton and laid a rationale for going up against Clinton, how to beat Clinton.
She was received pretty well.
She was, yeah. So that struck me as, especially for these 2016 potential contenders, that they focus so much on Obama when, they'll be running, you know, they'll try to connect Clinton to Obama, but he really won't be on.
Well, the RNC is already running, you know, sending out, you know, several hit pieces a week, you know, to the media on Hillary Clinton. It's not like the Republican establishment is all focused on
but the conservatives, the activists really don't. That's not
true.
Really riling them
up. And I would say if anybody there was going to actually, you know, call Hillary out by name, it would be Carly Fiorina, since she is the only woman in the Republican
field,
which numbers more than a dozen at this point. So,
Rand Paul though did talk about Hillary's war.
Okay,
he called Libya Hillary's war, and it was just I was watching and I just made a note. I was like, here we go. Note to everyone: it will henceforth be known by Republicans as Hillary's war. Is there anything there on message? So I thought we've got a new moniker for the Libyan conflict. So, but you're right. I mean, other than that, I didn't see. But certainly none of the people who registered. Just to be clear. Rand Paul was number one. Number two was Scott Walker. Number three was Ted Cruz. Number four was Ben Carson. And number five was Jeb Bush. And then it was like everybody else. Then it was like Bobby Jindal and Rick Perry and the rest of them. Rick Santorum did not do very well. Interestingly, I mean, he was received. To be fair, he did talk after Scott Walker, which is like a serious tough act to follow. But it was like crickets in there after, when he spoke, and he was trying to get the crowd riled up, and it's very difficult to do. The other thing was I wanted to point out the. Oh, never mind. I'll get back to it. I have my notes. Okay, what was I? Oh, Scott Walker. He was the only one I saw who got a standing ovation in the middle of a speech. Mm. Like, there were standing ovations at the end of speeches, but who had his speech interrupted by a standing ovation. When he talked about, I can't believe it took him a whole minute to get to it, but when he finally talked about the law that he had passed in Wisconsin that sort of a right to work, made it sort of right to work state for public employees. The crowd went wild, stopped standing up in the middle of the thing. So, I mean, he came in second. Rand Paul's people are devoted, energetic. But Scott Walker, who does need some polishing, as you know later, he sort of compared the union protesters to ISIS. So may need to have a powwow with his communications team about that. So, he was like, if I can stand 100,000 angry union protesters, I think I could deal with ISIS. And everyone was like, yeah. No.
Yeah, you walked that one back.
Yeah, even the crowd was like, I don't know if that's okay.
That was not where they stood up and applauded.
That was not it. But the point is, he needs some, you know, consultants. to help him out a little bit. But he did, he was extremely popular. Jeb Bush also, people said he went into a hostile room, but I didn't think so at all. He seemed pretty well received. Sean Hannity said yesterday people booed when they heard your name, and he said, everybody who booed, I'm going to put you down as undecided. And I was like, right on. You got to be bold to walk into that room and say what
you
said.
Sure, yeah.
Well, they weren't just picking on, for example, Barack Obama and occasionally Hillary Clinton and various Democrats. I mean, there were a lot of intra-party attacks. Ronald Reagan used to have his 11th commandment, you know, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. There are going to be a lot of Republicans seeking dispensation after CPAC, I think. But they weren't the only gathering of Republicans I want to talk about. Let's talk about the state gathering of, it was the GOP conference, Carson. What went on there? What was that like? Were they happy, optimistic, depressed?
It was probably one of the more optimistic meetings in quite some time, probably since the 2003 recall convention. It was interesting. You know, this past convention in Sacramento was the governing convention, so that's when all the board members are elected or reelected, and they go through a bunch of the business of the party. And what you found was, you know, Jim Brolte, the past chair, and he was reelected unanimously. No one even ran against him. Harmy Dillon, the vice chair, again also. And then the treasurer and the secretary for the party, again, ran unopposed. So you saw a massive amount of unity there. And overall, it's very upbeat. You know, the Republicans had some successes in 2014 at the state level, between the state assembly and the state senate. So amongst the activists there and amongst the party leadership there, they're making the steps to kind of revitalize the party, which is an important component because, you know, one party rule does not benefit really anyone in a state, whether it's Democratic or Republican. So you hope that they can kind of get their act together.
Yeah, Josh, I mean, they've had some victories in the last election.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've started calling the Brolte Doctrine,
yes.
You know, for Chairman Jim Brolte, which is we're not going to waste a lot of party money, of which they didn't have much for a long time, a lot of money, time, and resources trying to win these statewide races that we cannot win at this point. We're going to try to win, we're going to start winning local races. Mm-hmm. We're going to win... you know, we're going to get Republicans elected to nonpartisan local city councils and county board of supervisors, and then we're going to start targeting a few swing districts in the assembly, and we're going to get those. And it's a long game. You know, he's looking at several cycles ahead of building a bench of viable candidates that they can then back for statewide office. And so far... seems to be doing okay. I mean, the Bay Area has its first Republican assemblywoman, first Republican lawmaker in what was it, 7 or 8 years? You know, took a swing district out there in the East Bay, Catherine Baker, and they see her as a rock star. But they're not going to run her for statewide office just yet. You know, they know better than to jump the gun. You know, and you could say that Ashley Swearingen tried that last year for controller, but the party didn't sink a lot of resources into it. Mm-hmm. She did okay, you know. She came out of losing that election in a way that certainly preserves her for further runs later. She's been mentioned as a possible contender for either the Senate race in 2016 or, you know, something else somewhere down the line. So, I think the party is starting to see the value of this long view rather than the, you know, let's find somebody who can run, you know, right now for governor, and you know, we'll sink everything we have into that. Plus, they're not hemorrhaging money anymore, which is also a good thing.
Right.
You know,
so. What'll be, I think, the true test is whether they can hold a lot of those gains they made in 2014 and 2016 with a very different turnout, very different electorate. Sure. It'll be interesting to see if they can hold on to Catherine Baker's East Bay seat, whether David Hadley won in a Los Angeles suburban seat, whether they can kind of hold on to these ones that are democratically leaning districts. And if they can do that, then they're on the step, the right step toward kind of becoming a relevant party again.
Before we move on to our next topic, do you have a sense of how the Republicans, whether state ones or national ones, are feeling about the performance of the congressional GOP over the past couple of weeks? I mean, there was did you follow this whole deal with the potential shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security? And it really seems like Senate Republican leader and House Republican leader, you know, lost each other's phone numbers or aren't following each other
on
Twitter.
Well, the folks at CPAC are probably blaming John Boehner for not shutting it all down.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
I mean, they're the ones who are with, who are supporting those 50 or so House Republicans who are saying, we are going to defund the president's executive orders on immigration by any means necessary, and if that means letting the Department of Homeland Security's funding lapse entirely, we will do it. You know, that is what this 1 week continuing resolution is trying to get around. And I'm dying to see the end game on this. You know, if Boehner can actually get them to come along or what's gonna happen. It'll be very interesting. But CPAC was the kind of room that where that would be A-OK. That's what they want.
So they always say you have to be slightly insane to run for president. I really think you have to be completely insane to want to be Speaker of the House, because to deal with the, and the Democrats probably have this also, though, although they keep their differences behind closed doors a lot better.
That's the difference.
But to try to deal with all these very angry people against each other within your own caucus is, I don't envy him at all.
After that last election, there were all these panels like this, and people would say things like, well, now it's Republicans' turn to have to show that they know how to govern, and I would just laugh. Because no one ever went broke betting on government dysfunction. So I'm just, you know, this was kind of predictable. We knew there was this wing of people who were going to make it a problem. And then you saw John Boehner on the Sunday shows. This is the talking point, seriously. Well, we're family, you know, and families have differences.
I think it was the columnist and author P.J. O'Rourke about 30 years ago, before he was became incredibly conservative himself, who said, Republicans are the party that believe government doesn't work and then get elected and prove it.
On that note, let's move on to our last topic before the news quiz. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm calling this the anti-vaccination movement. As we mentioned last week, or last time on Week to Week, California has gotten a lot of attention for the past couple months, when many state number of state residents who have opted out of vaccinations, some on religious grounds, other on Jenny McCarthy grounds, on some various well-debunked claims that vaccinations cause other disorders. The comedian Jimmy Kimmel joked recently that Los Angeles area parents are more worried about gluten than they are about smallpox. So why are we talking about it in a political program? There's now some talk in Sacramento about legislation that would address this. Melissa, you recently discussed this on CBSSF. Do you want to tell us who's doing this and what it is and what are its chances?
Well, it is. The law has been proposed by a pediatrician who's also a state senator. You just can't get any better than that, as far as I'm concerned. And the law. So right now in California, there's two ways to get out of vaccinating your kids. One is two, actually three. Well, one is a medical exemption, right? If you've got like a compromised immune system or something, your doctor gives you the excuse. The second is a personal belief exemption. You don't really require much for that. That's kind of what most people use to get out of it. The third way, and it's not really, it's sort of kind of like a personal exemption, is to homeschool your children, right? Because the only way we know about vaccinations is when you try to enroll your child into school, public or private. In California, you have to disclose their vaccination history. So you could homeschool them. That's the other kind of way to get around it. What the legislation by Dr. Pan would do would be to get rid of that personal belief exemption. So if you want to go to school in California at a public or private school, you would have to have a medical excuse. So you're sort of foreclosing that other way out. Right now, it's not clear if there's going to be a religious exemption. So some states have the religious exemption in. It's not clear if he's going to actually do that or not. Here's the problem. When you write in a religious exemption, you can't write in like a narrow religious exemption. You can't write in an exemption that says you have to get your pastor or your rabbi or somebody to sign something. It has to be big. And here's why. Because I have to tell you about this case. There's this case out of Arkansas. And this woman, so Arkansas had a religious exemption. They still do. But you had to get like a signature from your, you know, the leader of your church or whatever it is. And she said, no, I don't have a leader. I read the Bible and angels tell me what to do. So she said, so she sued and won. And the court said, you know, if you're going to open the door to religious exemptions, you can't just say, you know, it's got to be one of the big three. You have to sort of open it up to people who feel like they have a personal, you know, phone line there. So we do know that if this gets built in, if this gets built back in, there could be a separate problem. But though, again, right now it's just been proposed to eliminate the, to eliminate that particular exemption. To be clear, this has been tried before, and it always fails because the anti-vaxxers are very organized. They have a lot of blogs. They talk to each other a lot. They're a small group of people, but they're very loud and opinionated and, like I said, organized. So this always scares legislators. However, this time around, because we actually had the actual sick children, the pro-vaccination side, as it were, has been equally, if not more, vocal. Now there's, it's just like, all right, enough. Because for a while it was just like, all right, crazy people. Now it's like, okay, I need to take my kid to the playground. And so the reason why it actually has a chance of passing now is for this, again, unfortunate reason of the outbreak. But I think that it's going to pass. Okay. Because, again, there's the anti-vaxxers are a small group, numerically small group. And the pro-vaccination folks have gotten themselves organized and have been motivated now to reach out to the legislators. So I think that it will pass, again, maybe with a religious exemption, maybe without, but it's definitely got legs, as it were, this time around. You know, again, sadly, it took some very sick people, like 136 instances of measles for that to happen. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
And, Carson, this isn't, I mean, I think we mentioned before, I mean, Democrats have ragged on Republicans quite a bit about anti-science issues with climate change and such. This is an area where a lot of this hits home for Democrats.
Oh, yeah, it does. If you look at vaccination rates across schools, and you can go onto the California state government's website, and they publish all of this sort of stuff. What you find is the schools in Marin County and Palo Alto and, you know, the bastion of progressive politics in California have some of the lowest, but then again, so do, you know, the most rural parts of the state. So why is it the case where the anti-vaxxers are so effective? It's because they can kind of go in from both sides. Like, they can pick off the Republicans and they can pick off the progressive Democrats as well. And that's why I think it's really struggled politically, because it's one of those few cases where kind of there it technically is far, far fringe bipartisan, but it technically is bipartisan.
But it's bringing America together. That's great.
But I agree. I think it'll probably pass this time, just because it's hard to believe any state legislature would look a parent in the face and say, sorry, no. Okay. Your kid's going to get measles because of this.
Well, very good. Let's try to get through some of these audience questions. A couple on education. Someone asks, how much does anyone know this? How much does California Lotto contribute to education? Wasn't that the reason given to justify the state lottery? It hasn't exactly bailed out our education system, has it?
No, not enough.
Extraordinarily small.
I don't know the dollar figure offhand, but I mean it's not something that is a significant portion of the money that needs. You know, that is in the state budget.
Do we know, we were talking before about, you know, Silicon Valley's performance, the tax revenues are very dependent upon, you know, these big major industries in the state. Do we know, does the lottery income go revenue, does that go down in bad times, or does it even go up because people are
desperate?
Yeah.
Well, they always, I mean, they say Las Vegas, they always say that, you know, Vegas doesn't really have recessions because, you know, even in bad times, people will go and gamble. Yeah. However, the most recent recession actually broke that rule. But I'm not sure about that, but I doubt it changes much.
Well, whenever you have things like the lottery that are supposed to give a certain amount of money to education, what happens is whatever that amount is just gets taken out. So if you have a $100 education budget and you get $20 new from the lottery, you just take $20 out and spend it on something else. So you don't actually get a net increase in education spending, mm-hmm. even though you've got all this yay lottery money coming into it, just means we're buying broken bolts for the Bay Bridge.
This is getting depressing. Another education question is talking about the high cost of education, in particular for certain things like, you know, medical and dentistry. If the costs to the students are not increased, and if the California government does not increase financial support, if these costs obviously would continue to increase, where would this lead? So, I mean, is anyone addressing just kind of that overall, you know, the higher education, advanced education issues as to what it would do to certain parts of our workforce?
There have been reports that show that California is not educating people for the high-skilled mm-hmm. jobs, you know, medicine, engineering, STEMs. So that is impacting California's workforce currently. You know, a way around that is immigration. But of course, you know, D.C. is preventing any sort of reforms on that. So it's a tough issue because it's hard.
Well, one of the issues, I mean, we know that under Obamacare, we've got arguably a shortage of doctors, primary care providers. One thing that's been proposed, that keeps getting proposed, that is proposed again this year, is allowing nurse practitioners to do more. So we're sort of trying to push down some of the things that we usually use doctors to do and give other people authority to do them, sort of who don't have to go through the 6 years and then an additional 2 years of a fellowship. So I'm not sure if that's the ideal solution, but that seems to be where we're going to try to find more people who can write prescriptions and do sort of perform basic medical functions.
Okay. Question, I think it's perfect for Josh. Uh-oh. Why is Barbara Boxer retiring, and who is likely to succeed her? Challengers other than Kamala Harris, do you know?
Barbara Boxer is retiring because she's not – probably not going to get back in the majority and get her chairmanship back. And even if she did, she's already had a bite at the apple on the issue that's most important to her, which is climate change. And she couldn't get it done while she was chair. And unless all of Congress were to go over to Democratic control and have a Democratic president at the same time, it's unlikely that she would be able to get a bill through and signed. So she doesn't see, you know, within her effective lifetime, the ability to get that issue done. And I don't think she really was terribly interested in hanging around and being the loyal or disloyal opposition, which can be an important role, you know, to be out there yelling at Jim Inhofe, you know, mm-hmm. that climate change really does exist, you know, whether you believe it or not.
They've got snowballs.
She has grandkids. She's fought the fight. And I think she decided it was time to, you know, sort of step back. All the polls show Kamala Harris is the most popular person who seems interested in the job. There was a field poll recently that showed that actually the person for whom most Californians were inclined to vote was former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who has said, easy now, who has said she has no plans to run. Plus, you know, I think she wants to be NFL commissioner, but that's a whole other story.
She does.
The thing about that poll, the thing about any poll 2 years out, essentially, is that it's a name recognition thing more than anything else. And I think a lot of Republicans were hoping she would get into the race. A lot of Democrats know who she is, or know her name at least, you know, and so when you take a poll like that, you know, somebody like that rises to the top. I think had she run, and I think she knows this, had she run, all those photos of her standing with George W. Bush and the phrase weapons of mass destruction, you know, would have been something that you would have been hearing all through 2016 leading up to that election. So that's probably not going to happen. Antonio Villaraigosa opted out, who was sort of seen as you know, a main possible challenger to Kamala Harris. Doesn't mean that there won't be a challenger. Loretta Sanchez is still thinking about it. Southern California Latina congresswoman who may or may not want to give up a district that she holds that was very hard won back in the day down there in Orange County. Mm-hmm. You know, it's anybody's guess if she really wants to take this gamble. And there are other people as well. On the Republican side, the pickings are slim. Who knows who Assemblyman Rocky Chavez is? Right. So he's probably going to be in the race. And I think you'll probably, in the next couple of weeks, you'll see other people who nobody knows, make their decisions. No disrespect, I like the guy, but Tom Del Beccaro from here in Lafayette, a former chairman of the state party, has opened an exploratory committee, which means exploring if anybody knows who Tom Del Beccaro is. And the answer right now is basically no. So it's early. Kamala doesn't have it locked up, but I wouldn't be betting against her either.
It's actually kind of funny in my opinion because right now there are more Republicans talking about actually running than there are Democrats. And the Republicans don't have a chance. I don't know why everyone's so interested in this race.
Sorry.
I don't know why there aren't more Democrats in this race, because they can actually have a chance.
We were
of winning.
So excited.
I know.
We were like, yes, like 100 people are going to run, and no.
No, they're all going to run for governor.
They're all
going to run for governor.
2018 is going to be busy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think it's time for our news quiz. So if my news quiz assistant can come up here and get the prizes. For those of you who have not been here when we did this before, do you like my beautiful Walgreens bag?
The way we
do it is I'll ask a question. If you think you know the answer, just raise your hand. I'll point at you, and you can shout it out. If you're right, you will get a little chocolate prize. If you're wrong, just sadness. Okay. The first question is, the longest-serving woman in Congress is going to retire. Who is she? Mm. Ma'am, I'm sorry I saw your hand first. Barbara Mikulski, that's right, Democrat of Maryland. Okay, next. Just days after a 75-car pileup there left 17 people injured, what is Maine's legislature contemplating doing? Did anyone see this story? Ma'am? That's correct. They're considering removing the law mandating seatbelt use by adults.
Interesting.
It's Maine.
I can't say anything.
Okay. A 21-year-old man in Nebraska was arrested for possession of marijuana after police found a container in his car. What did the container have a label on it saying?
Weed.
Anyone want to make a guess, sir? No, but close.
Well, it is right next to Colorado.
Well, you're very close. Sir? No. In the back? No. Okay, I'm just going to have to say it. He actually had a label on it that said, not weed. It was filled with weed. Okay. Here's one. I'll bet there are going to be a lot of hands for this. Who topped Forbes' latest list of the world's richest people? Sir, right here in front, sorry.
That would be Mr. Gates.
Bill Gates, that's right.
Back on top.
Are you serious?
Yes, I am.
It's a good neighbor to have, I think.
I'm not far behind.
Okay. In its response to the killing of a 12-year-old boy who had a toy gun last fall, whom did the city of Cleveland say was to blame for the child's death? Sir? The 12-year-old boy, right. Yes. Actor William Shatner says he feels awful about missing the funeral of whom? Leonard Nimoy, that's correct. Last week saw the death of what longtime Chicago White Sox player who was also the first black Latino Major League Baseball player? And, sir, I saw your answer. Minnie Minoso, that is correct. Two more. A pro-Russian political party linked to Vladimir Putin was expected to win, but it failed to win elections in what European country yesterday? Mm. Did anyone see that? Raise your hand. Sorry?
Latvia, Estonia?
You were the only one who said anything, so it was Estonia. So,
yeah.
Congratulations. And one more. Saturday Night Live drew criticism this weekend for a commercial spoof that made fun of what?
ISIS and Toyota
commercial. Right, ISIS. And they did a spoof of a Toyota commercial. You can see it on YouTube. I don't know. Look, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on our next program. Wednesday, April 1st, week-to-week roundtable right here at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to our panel, Josh Richmond, Melissa Griffin-Kane, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you here and everyone listening online or watching on TV. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time.